never met somebody I can't learn something from. Yeah. Sometimes it's what not to do, but everybody's got a gift, and seeing that in them and seeing the light in them is,
yeah,
I guess, part of my shtick.
Yeah.
You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation.
Joining me today on SPX is Chip Webster. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good to see you again, Joe.
You too. I've always enjoyed our conversations, yeah, and I know this one will be no different. You've had a fantastic and interesting life. Cliff Notes are, well, at least that I know of you, professional Cliff Notes are, ran Tiger 21 for many years.
No, just a few years. I did the Vistage.
Vistage. But essentially, you were in the soup of high-powered executives for a long time, and that's a cool place to be. Bought an RV, did some traveling, saw the country,
right?
And you're an author. It's a new book that just came out, Unity and Service,
right?
Which we're going to talk about. Let's go back a little bit before that. So before Vistage days, and you know, start a little bit at the beginning and come up. What was life for you before Vistage days?
Well, you know, I started out of college working for Sears, thinking I wanted to be president, and worked my way into the Sears Tower. Realized that big bureaucracies weren't my cup of tea, and I got recruited to leave to a small New York stock exchange company in Jacksonville called Save a Stop. It's no longer exists, and ended up being a group vice president. But there was a real cultural mismatch. I didn't know that by name then, but I just, it wasn't the right place for me. Ended up back in California, went from originally in the design and graphics business, put together brands for Sears. And once again, it was owned by a public company, and I was an officer of one of their subsidiaries, but I really am entrepreneurial, and I figured out entrepreneurs are unemployed and unemployable. Yeah. So I did different stuff like selling vending equipment, published independent phone books, and then a friend of mine told me about this thing called Tech, which is now called Vistage. And
Independent phone books?
Yeah, I published independent phone books.
Can I have the 2 minutes? What is that business? And I mean, I get it what it is, but how did it work?
Well, this was back in the 80s.
Right.
And people don't know it, but the phone book was the most profitable thing the phone telcos had. And we found out we could compete with them. So we would go into smaller markets. The first market I did was west of Atlanta. So it was Carrollton, Bowden, Villarica, and Bremen. They all had these little tiny phone books. And Carrollton was really the center. So we came in and consolidated directories and put all those phone books into one, white pages and yellow pages. We made the print bigger in the white pages so people could read it. And then we sold ads, and then we put local sports teams in the West Georgia College schedule and made it a real community.
Right.
And then the cover was always a local landmark. And we did that all in North Carolina, South Carolina.
And so who owned data for that, all the numbers, and public record?
Yeah, it was. They had to sell us. The telcos had to sell us the white pages.
Right, and it had to be at a reasonable price. They weren't trying to hose you.
But
yeah, okay.
Right.
And then, so were you in situations then where you were delivering your telephone book and they were delivering their telephone book, and you just wanted yours to be used, and sometimes people had two, or?
Well, everybody had two.
Yeah.
And what we found, at each place I did it, there would be a small college, and I worked with a small college marketing professor and have them do a telephone survey.
Yeah.
And we were the number one phone book in every market because everything was there. They could read it, and the other schedules, et cetera, were in there. Right.
And as your business progressed and matured, did they ever reach out and say, hey, let's not compete, let's partner, or did they ever just give up and start doing theirs?
What happened in the end of when I left, Ameritech, which was a telco in the Midwest, was consolidating these independent phone book companies.
Okay.
And they made us an offer that we should not have refused. I had partners. I was a minority interest.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to take it. And my good friends we had all this cash, and they were buying airplanes and buying buildings, never knew about leasing. They just didn't understand cash flow.
Right.
They were great guys, but not business people.
Right.
And I called a friend of mine who was our house counsel at the company in Jacksonville and told him what was going on. And he said, you need to get out of there. So I sold my interest, never got paid all the way through, and then came down here, started from scratch, Vistage, and I was the first successful Vistage chair in the Tampa Bay market.
Interesting. And in your childhood, did you, you know, a lot of entrepreneurialism starts very early. I was a baseball card guy. Did you have a newspaper route or some kind of entrepreneurialism in your early days?
Yeah. I've been told by my mom, I don't totally remember this. I used to sell yesterday's newspapers to ladies in the neighborhood before I was in kindergarten in nice. Burbank, California. Right. And then when we moved to Ventura, we had avocado trees and stuff. So I'd sell fruit and vegetables. And the first guy who paid me to do anything, it was probably in the third or fourth grade, was Joe McConnell, who washed our windows. We had a two-story house, and the guy would come and wash our windows. And he gave me his business cards, and he paid me to go knock on doors and hand out his window washing cards. And the rest is history.
The rest is history. Long and varied history. So Vistage, which was called, you said, Tech?
It was originally the Executive Committee Tech.
A tech. So talk about what those types of businesses are for people that might not be familiar.
Sure, sure. It's really a peer group with a facilitator / we're called coaches now. But it's a wonderful organization where you bring together these CEOs that work together for a long time. Some of the groups have been together for 40 and 50 years, second generation. I was fortunate enough to have some really interesting people, which I'll talk about in a minute. But you get together once a month and work on opportunities. Where am I going? What do I need to do? What's the strategy? And then you meet with the chair in between each meeting where you really get down to the nitty gritty. And what you find out is everything's related to everything. Mm-hmm. You know, when I got out of college, I said, leave your personal problems at home and come to work. The human shows up, you know? So we'd end up with divorces or kids on drugs but working through with peers who had been there and done that and had this great and cared about each other and would hold each other accountable, which was a really interesting part of it. You remember Discount Auto Parts. Mm-hmm. They remember the group, and we talked through them going public. And Gordon Tunstall helped them go public. Checkers, Herb Brown, was in the group, and he was running out of cash. I don't know if you remember when you'd be driving down the street, and there'd be two Checkers trucks with the kiosks that they would carry and then drop on pads. And he was growing so fast, he ran out of money, and he came to the group and said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I may have to declare bankruptcy. And we said, stop right now. Gordon Tunstall said, I'll get you some interim financing, took him public, and saved him. But it was, I mean, story after story. Like that. Those are the more visible ones.
And what was the structure, as you as a facilitator, what was the structure of a meeting? Was it very free flow, or did you have an agenda?
I had an agenda. We would bring in speakers. I was very fortunate to have Peter Schutz, the former president of Porsche, in many times, mm-hmm. talking about how he turned Porsche around and then talking about life cycles of corporations. Clark Johnson, who built Pier 1 Imports from less than $100 million to $1 billion. He retired a long time ago before it went bankrupt. Just people like that.
Yeah.
They would sit for 3 hours and have a conversation with 12, 13 people. So it was a real interactive, and they really could pick each other's brains. So after the speaker would leave, then I'd have an agenda, and there would be what we call them issues, but they're really, what are the biggest opportunities that you need to be working on? And members would come and say, I'm going to do this, this, and this. And then say, you know, 3 months later, what have you done? Well, I haven't done, you know, so it was a lot of accountability.
Yeah.
You may have remember a company called Southern Culvert. They were the largest pipe manufacturer mm-hmm. in the state of Florida. And, you know, Kel had been a member of the group for probably 10 years. And he came to one of the meetings and said, I'm going to go sell my, going to meet a buyer tomorrow and I'm going to sell the business. Well, when I've been having lunch with this guy every month for 10 years, you think I have a feel for him?
Yeah.
And I just said, who's going to represent you? Well, you know, I went to Harvard and I've been in the second generation in the business. I can represent myself. He was kind of tight. I stopped the meeting and I said, how many of you think he should represent himself? So nobody raised his hand. And we got, I don't know if you remember Terry Aidman, Aidman Pizer, but Terry represented him. So I knew that Kel would take $18 million for the business. Terry got him $36
million. Wow.
And what he did, which was so neat, is this was a big international concrete company. They knew all the costs. They wanted his P&Ls. And he said, I'll tell you how much concrete I buy a year, cement to create the pipes. You tell me what it's worth. It's just a great story.
Yeah, it's a clever perspective. Wow.
Yeah.
And there, it was a somewhat higher-end group, right? There was a minimum revenue threshold.
Well, yeah, in those days you needed to have, what do we say, 3 million and 20 employees. But we had Ring Power. You know, we had a lot of big companies. And what I found was interesting that it wasn't necessarily how big they were, but who they were. I don't know if you remember John West of System One Staffing. He didn't qualify on paper.
Right.
But I saw this spark in him, and he sold his business for $85 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, and yeah. He will tell you in his early years that Vistage made a big difference.
You know, nowadays on YouTube and in places like that, sort of personal business betterment is right. There's just bajillions of hours of content right. of it. And this was essentially your life for a couple of decades.
Yeah.
And so you're feeding that back all into helping them. But,
right.
you know, for you personally, then how did you leverage that personally in your own career?
Well, it was funny. And a number of people, in fact, when Dennis Fontaine, unfortunately, was dying right after we went public, that's Discount Auto Parts. He said he learned more at Vistage than he did in Harvard.
Wow.
Because it was real bullets, real blood on the table, people's net worth on the table. Mm-hmm. I mean, these weren't theories. These were not case studies. And you're there every month and you see what happens. I won't say his name. I had a member who kept bringing the same problem. He was a significant business in the area, mm-hmm. kept bringing the problem. And one day I said, stop. The group has told you what to do. I want you to leave the meeting right now and go do what we've told you to do and don't come back until you did it. He left, never came back, and the business tanked. If he had done what the group had tried to get him to do, he might still have been in business.
You know, for you personally, that is a bold move. I mean, it probably seems logical to you.
I was absolutely, I can't believe I did it after I did it. Yeah. I walked out, what did I just do?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to lose a member. I liked the guy. He was a friend. But he needed to do it.
And part of that is not only what's right for him, but it probably detracts from the group experience to hear the same problem over and over again.
We are not going to sit here and listen to you whine. You're either going to play the game or go sit on the bench.
Nice.
And that's what made the group work. You know, when I was president of Vistage Florida, we were up to like 75 groups and 900 members, and I would go visit. And some chairs, you know, it was just a nice social thing. And other chairs, it was like, no, we're here to play the game.
Yeah.
Real bullets, real money.
Well, I'd be remiss not to ask you then, what are some of the most common traits of the most successful? I mean, you had the, you know, you were front row for a lot of the most successful people in business.
You know, I, for a long time, said it's passion. You know, I look at these guys, and passion can be just demonstrated in different ways. It can be very steady, but just consistent. I think passion, I think curiosity, mm-hmm. being willing to challenge what you're doing, always wanting to take it to the next level, the ability to put the right people on the team, what's really hard. I mean, I've suffered from this at times, is not wanting to let somebody go who's not helping us. I think taking risks, passion, curiosity, and the ability to attract people and build trust. Mm. Trust, I now believe, is the foundation of everything.
Yeah. It's the lubricant for business engine, right?
Right.
It's, everything runs smoother if you have trust.
Right, right. And, you know, your job is to get the right people on the bus and in the right seats. That metaphor.
I think passion is... You know, I see it as a fuel for a lot of those other things.
Yeah.
If you're passionate about something, you're going to be naturally curious. You're going to persevere.
Right.
You're going to be more trustworthy because the passion is authentic. You know, right. It just underlies a lot of the other qualities.
Another friend of mine who was in the direct selling business used to say, the secret success is when you're down, get up and don't kick a skunk.
Yeah.
You know? So I guess part of it is knowing what battle to take.
Yeah, pragmatism. So, you know, you basically then ran that. There was a transition to Tiger 21.
Yeah, I retired from running Vistage Florida and was kind of bored. And a friend of mine was trying to get a group going and he never could get it going. And he said, why don't you try it? And I did it for about 18 months. And COVID came and my wife's immunocompromised. She's a retired cardiologist, so she's really dialed into all this. And she was still working part-time. And this is in January, February of 2020. And we're sitting, we live at Beach Drive, and we're looking out at the yacht club, and we just got this neat little cruiser. We were going to spend a lot of time on the water. And she didn't want to ride up and down in the elevators. Because, you know, if you're immunocompromised, you got COVID, it was the death sentence. So I said, well, why don't we buy an RV? Mm. I thought she'd say no. But we have kids in Seattle, San Diego, St. Louis, Philadelphia, and here. And we weren't going to fly to see grandkids. So we bought an RV and we did 5 loops of the U.S. for about 6 months at a time. Mm-hmm. And it's fabulous. I mean, I had crossed the country a couple of times before in a car. She had. And, you know, to go to Monument Valley, places I've always wanted to go, but are in the middle of nowhere. You have to want to get there. You know, you can't go through Monument Valley. And the only state I had not been in was North Dakota.
Right.
You know, everybody makes a joke about North Dakota.
Yeah.
So she's from Minnesota, a little town, Alexandria. And I'll never forget driving the RV and crossing the North Dakota border, thinking, okay, you know, it's going to be ugly. It was fabulous. We were at the right time of the year that we were driving across North Dakota, and all the sunflowers were being were in bloom, and they follow the sun. So we were going east to west, and as we're going, the flowers are turning with us.
Nice.
And then we ended up in the Teddy Roosevelt Badlands, surrounded by a herd of buffalo. I mean, it was just, there's no place in the country isn't beautiful. And if you haven't done what we did, you know, spend the time appreciating this country and the diversity, you're missing a great opportunity. I've traveled in Europe a fair amount, you know, been to Tahiti, been to a lot of beautiful places, but this country is amazing. And the cultural differences, you know, you're in RV parks and you get to know people, and it's just, it was fabulous.
And you told me about that. I mean, and some of the people that you met were precursors for the book, right. Unity and Service.
Right.
One thing I immediately thought that you didn't really, for you, it seemed really natural, but interacting with high-powered executives on the daily and then hanging out in a mobile home park, right. Two very different experiences.
Yes, yeah.
But you seem to find value in both of them. The way you transitioned into that, it was impressive to me. It came to my mind when we talked about it.
You know, Joe, I've never met somebody I can't learn something from. Yeah. Sometimes it's what not to do, but everybody's got a gift, and seeing that in them and seeing the light in them is, I guess, part of my shtick.
Yeah. Everybody is expert. I mean, if I sit down next to a plumber at a party, I want to walk away knowing a lot about plumbing because that's a valuable experience. And I, you know, it's, I think,
So there's this story. I always, if I, you know, sit in a bar or wherever I am, I just start talking to people around me. So I'm flying from Tampa to LA, but I had to go through Dallas. So I'm changing planes in Dallas and I go in the bar to get a sandwich, and two guys come and sit down next to me, and I start talking to them. The guy, he was kind of rude. He said, "Why are you even talking to me? You don't know who I am. You'll never see me again." I said, "Well, I don't know. What do you do?" "Well, I work for Sunset Magazine." "Oh, really? Have you ever heard of the Wall Wizard?" His face goes white. "We're flying to Minneapolis to meet the Wall Wizard. The Wall Wizard's my neighbor when I was living in Brandon. The world is so small." Yeah. When I was in Tahiti picking up a boat in Taha, which is a little island outside of the main island, who walks in but Maggie Valdez, who was, you know, AMI Kids?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was the executive secretary and assistant to the CEO of AMI Kids. She'd married a guy and they were sailing around the world, and they stopped into the moorings because they had great local charts. And here we are, you know, literally on the other side of the world.
The world, yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. I've had experiences like that traveling as well.
Yeah, it's fun.
So Unity and Service, which did come from a lot of your observations in how our society has sort of evolved.
Or devolved.
Or devolved. So you write, what inspired, what made you think that these observations that you had needed to go into book form?
Well, I've been watching this deterioration of trust and social interaction for years. And I think the final catalyst was talking to people around these. You'd go to an automobile park and you start talking, and you know, where are you from, and you know, oh, your RV is a Tiffin or your RV is a Integra or whatever, and how's that working, and where do you get this done? And then all of a sudden you end up talking about the direction of the country, and 99% of the people were not happy. And I'd listen and I'd say, well, you know, we have the government we deserve, and they look at me like I had three heads. Well, democracy is a do-it-to-ourselves project. And they say, well, what can I do? I'm just one person. Would you know anybody that's not just one person? And the evidence of this detachment of it's our country, when you look at voter turnout, presidential elections range from 58 to 66% over the last five elections. That's only two-thirds of the people electing the president in the Senate in the four-year, and in the midterms, it's like ranges from 36 to I think it's 58. That's unacceptable. I think it was an Air Force general said, nobody ever washed or rent a car. Well, I don't think people realize that we own this country. Yeah. They think they're renting it and they're just passing through.
Yeah.
There's no equity. And that's why what the kind of work you're doing in nonprofits and bringing people together in St. Pete is so important.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you hit the nail on the head is that I'm only one person. It's the disconnectedness, and they feel like that there's a machine at work that is partly, and again, sometimes you immediately point to is a dissatisfaction with the government.
Right.
I think it's also a dissatisfaction born of there being perceived evil next door to them. And this comes down to the entrenchment of the different sides of the spectrum, yes. The left and the right. And right. So, you know, it's so binary that it's hard to ever be satisfied when you're convinced on a daily basis and having that this perspective reinforced that half the country is evil and working for its destruction.
Right.
And the other half thinks the same thing about you.
Yeah.
And so you will never be satisfied in that environment, regardless what the government
right.
does.
And the big joke is there's now more independents registered than Republicans or Democrats.
Yeah. Which is probably a great thing eventually. You know, at least it's a seed of independent thinking.
Right. Yeah. But the challenge is in 48 states, they basically have what are called sore loser laws. They're described and designed differently. So if you run in a primary as a Republican or a Democrat and you lose, even though you would be the one that they want elected because the extremes are win the primaries, mm-hmm. which is one of our problems. So you would be a good third candidate and probably win and be someone who can work across the aisle instead of throwing hand grenades at each other. You can't run.
Interesting.
Yeah. The two-party system is a duopoly that is really working hard to destroy the other side.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's not sustainable. And, you know, third party, that may be the answer, but certainly getting opening up. When we go back to, I was just at the Reagan Library about 2 weeks ago, which was, you know, and I think of Ronnie and Tip sitting and having a beer on Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, how do we move the country forward? We're not doing that now.
Yeah. Well, if I may offer this, you know, it's a multi-layered problem, obviously.
It's that simple.
Some core elements I think are I think complexity and the proliferation of expertise leads to actually homogeneity because, you know, as the internet has grown, you know, you can go on YouTube and if you're into left-handed butterflies, there's hundreds of hours of endless rabbit holes of left-handed butterflies.
Yep.
So people in one perspective, and obviously issues have multiple perspectives, but people can go down and have an absolutely convincing experience in one perspective. That's true. Doesn't mean there aren't five other perspectives that are also true. But because of that, that complexity is brought back to the average person, and that complexity about left-handed butterflies mixed with 10,000 other complexities is overwhelming to a person trying to make ends meet. And so they rely on proxies. And so that's where the, you know, the Tucker Carlsons of the world or those folks come in and say, okay, I'm this type of demographic. I'm this type of archetype. I'm going to find an archetype that is closest to me, and I'm going to trust them to distill this world for me because there's no chance of me doing it on my own. And of course, those people are often in the media. And if you layer in all the motivations of being in the media and becoming those proxies, a lot of them are tied to finances and cult personalities that are also back, you know, tied back into power plays and finances and stuff. And so, you know, the mechanism itself of distilling information has been, you know, is hijacked by people who aren't necessarily in there for pragmatic to optimal good. They're in there for other things, but it's all people have to rely on. And so you have this sort of half-informed.
I think half is generous.
Yeah, okay. And then, you know, the other piece of that is marketing has gotten so effective. You know, the marketers are so far evolved over our brain's ability to cope with that. You know, and there's a weird example I read that in extreme sports, like nobody had ever done a 540 or something like that. And, you know, somebody finally did it and it was like the 4 minute mile kind of vibe.
Exactly.
And then they engineered it and now it's a common trick.
Right.
And it's like the engineering of all this stuff has gone so deep now that people can't, you know, it's a new normal that people aren't ready for. But what marketers want and what cult of personalities want is devoutness, right? Because they want the maximum influence they can have, which then, you know, with social media and this whole mechanism, people's identities now, it's their political beliefs are their religion. And they believe as deeply as in a religion and the other, and religious wars have toppled countries for generations. And now it's in a more civilized environment, but it's essentially the, you know, the ingrainedness is so deep that it's hard to separate any issue because you can't go to your priest and say, I believe in all these things about Jesus, but I don't believe in this thing about Jesus, right? It's just the law. The Bible is the Bible, and the priest distills that for you, and it's, you know, individual thought. It's not a part of that, because then you're rejected by your tribe, right, if you get too individualized and stuff. And so the whole mechanism is now set up to have partially informed but deeply emotionally connected people who incentivize the people who do that are incentivized to make the other as evil as possible to keep this part in line. So it's a, you know, that's sort of a structural overview that I see. But.
Can I read a poem?
Please, yes.
It's called Microvalidations. Mm. You know me in poetry.
Yeah.
You taught me the word ekphrastic. I still love that word.
Yeah.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. English proverb. Microclimates, microbiomes, microaggressions. We live in a microclimate. Microbiomes live in us. Microaggressions are part of life. What we need more of are microvalidations, more microaffirmations. We've become trapped in our silos. We've become contemptuous of those who don't agree with us. They must not be human. Our country, our cities, our friends have become divided. We can't keep distancing ourselves from each other. We must all hang together, or most assuredly we'll hang separately. Mm. Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah.
Our children, our grandchildren need us to hang together for their future. A healthy democracy requires its citizens to work together to remain free. What we need to see our interdependence and break down the barriers that divide us. We need each other. Start with micro-validations. Open the door for someone and say hello. Talk to your neighbors. Look people in the eye and acknowledge they exist. Reconnect with each other. Affirm the humanness in everyone.
Perfect.
And, you know, having what I would walk all these places too. Mm-hmm. And Minnesota Nice, other, you know, what's what they're trying to put in the news now, but Minnesota Nice is real. I mean, Alexandria, Minnesota, a little tiny town where Deb was born. She hadn't been there since she was like 6 or 7. And people are just so friendly. Hi, how are you? And you'd be walking down the street and the car would have the right of way, but they'd stop and make you, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then I'd be walking in Chula Vista, which is just south of San Diego, along this beautiful walk along the bay. And people were just, they didn't want to even look at you. You know, they turn their head. So I'd do different things, different times. Like I'd say hi to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, 90% would ignore me and others would light up like a Christmas tree. You see me.
In the small Minnesota town, there's a homogeneity there, right? In Chula Vista, it's more diverse.
Very diverse.
Is that a fair statement?
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the only variable, but yes. Culture. You know this in business. Culture, each strategy, every time.
Yeah. But in culture, again, I think it's figuring out where the connection points are and making those the focus versus the non-connection points, right? Yeah.
What's our common ground? That's why I urge people to go and volunteer.
Yeah.
I'm on the board, chairman of the board now of Tampa Bay Watch. Great board. I'm very diverse politically. Great human beings. And what's so much fun is we actually, another board member articulated this so beautifully. We're working on something bigger than ourselves to make Tampa Bay healthier. It's not about who we voted for. It's about the bigger, the greater good working together. And I don't know if you know this or not, but we now filter 1 billion gallons a day through the oyster beds that we put out there.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And I think that the key there is, you know, this is, again, what I think is one of the real nefarious elements of social media is you have all this energy, this intellectual and emotional energy, and no place to go with it.
Right.
The only place that energy gets expressed is by verbally defeating someone in a semantical argument. You know, if you're talking about the Ukraine, you're not going to impact the Ukraine.
No.
And so the only place, but you have energy about it, right? Yeah. And you have emotion about it. And the only place for that to go is in these semantic values. You go back to Tampa Bay Watch, you can do something about it, right? You're there, local, you're experiencing it, you're hands-on.
Right.
And it completely changes the dynamic and the place, you have a place for the energy to go at a very basic level.
My guess is, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, if we took all the people in the United States, adults, and put them in a room, probably 80% of us are going to agree on 90% of the issues.
Yeah, 100%.
But, thank you. 100% of the 80, right? But the whole game is to divide us. You know, it's a bit of 1984.
Yeah. And for me, I've been thinking about, and we have a Community Voices section on the Catalyst, and I actually wrote this in there, this, you know, exact example. To me, if I could push any one concept out there, is that people, you know, I think it's a statement, people who can hold multiple opposing perspectives in their head and make sense of them, right. That's real intelligence.
Right.
And to me, that's multi-perspectivism, right? Mm-hmm. And so in the example I have in the Catalyst is, if you have asked someone to describe a house, if there's, you know, there's a funnier example with an elephant, but if you ask somebody to describe a house, if they're standing in front of it, or in back of it, or if they're in space looking at it, or if they're looking at it through a microscope, or if they're inside of it, or if they call it home, if it's their home, they're all going to describe that house differently.
Sure.
They're all true, right?
Right.
And so leaders and thinkers should be the people who understand all of those perspectives and can distill those out and get us to a place of alignment with all that being considered, whereas the person in the front of the house is seeing their thing and arguing with the person in the back of the house, and they're never going to meet because they're seeing two different sides of the house.
Right. I used to, when I did strategic planning as one of the warm-up exercises, I'd write an E on the flip chart, and then I'd turn it. It's a W. It's a 3. It's an M.
Yeah.
And we needed all those perspectives. So then I'd draw sort of a weird object and then put a circle around it. Now, where you are on looking at exactly what you described.
Yeah.
And what we need is a leader or leaders who sit down and say, okay, we need to work on this together. I need your perspective. This democracy requires a pluralistic society. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just monolithic. And that's totalitarianism. I can never say the word right. And that, we know what that leads to. You know, if you want to live in China and have your social score kept every day, I guess you should go there.
Yeah.
But that's not democracy. That's not where creativity happens. And that's not where freedom happens. I couldn't write this book if I was in China.
Yeah. I was going to ask, you know, you are in, can we share your age?
Turning 80 in March.
Congratulations.
I haven't made it yet.
That's the age of enlightenment, right?
Yeah,
80 years. So you're there.
Yeah, 80's the new 70.
Nice. You know, what's your general feeling if I said, in your mind, describe the average 18-year-old. What are the first things that pop in your mind?
Well, first of all, there's no one single definition. So I've met some that are working hard in specific areas. They give me great hope for the future. And then I've met some who, I guess this one kid who's graduating from high school, well, what are you going to do? What do you want to do? Oh, I just want to be happy. Oh, I'm going to do what makes me happy. Well, how are you going to add value? What are you doing now? You know, the parents have let these kids sit in the basement and play video games. They haven't had to go out and work. Amazing number of kids don't drive now, which is about independence. I can't remember. I was listening to a podcast. Like, I talked about the 30-year-old kid in the basement smoking dope and, you know, mom and dad taking care of him. So I think it depends on how they were raised, who they are and their basic core personality. Back to, are they curious? Are they passionate? Do they have a goal? Do they see themselves as something bigger than themselves?
Right.
So I didn't answer your question exactly. I don't think one size fits all. I think the common thing is that they're lazy and don't, everybody gets a trophy.
And what I'm kind of going with is I'm trying to juxtapose the environment. Mm-hmm. You know, so I guess I would say when I grew up, in your book, you have the Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, you know, and to me, those were sort of, I don't know the best way to say it, but they were seminal, basic documents, right? But extrapolating that out, I feel like when I grew up, if I was super intellectual and super academic, that I could almost touch 10% of all the knowledge in the world. I mean, it's just a made-up number, right?
Right, sure.
But I feel like the average kid today couldn't touch 1% of one subject, right? Because the proliferation of information with the internet and with experts and with media channels that literally, like, if you just wanted to play, we're in St. Pete Athletic now recording this, just really get into pickleball, that there is legitimate progress, both academic and physical, mindset, emotional, that you could go deep down a rabbit hole to the exclusion of everything else in life. And, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think there's a beauty in that depth, right? But it does preclude a generalism that I think we had, you know, and maybe this is rosy glasses looking at the past. I think it precludes a generalism that actually was responsible for a lot of the connective tissue we had. Because in Minnesota, the same 100 thoughts are in most people's head. And it was much easier when there were only 1,000 thoughts to have, right? And now I feel like every kid could have 10 billion thoughts And we just aren't, by sheer volume, aren't able to have as many connection points to have connection in the way we used to. And so even some of those things about service and understanding our history and our nation and things like that are so diluted with everything else that is made important to people that it's hard to find enough common ground at a scale. And so I feel like we have to define new common grounds at scale that can be that connective tissue that makes sense in our current input landscape.
You know, you just teed up my big, hairy, audacious goal.
Okay.
Universal service.
Yeah.
You turn 18,
yeah.
You serve the country for a year. You leave St. Pete, you leave Alexandria, Minnesota, and go someplace else, work with kids around the country. On the old, remember the Civilian Conservation Corps?
Mm-hmm.
On those kind of projects.
In fact,
interesting, when I was in Alexandria, the county building was built by the WPA, which was a similar kind of program. Roosevelt, and it was an executive order. It wasn't passed by Congress, created the CCC.
Yeah.
And people would get involved with each other, know each other, and understand it's my country. I guarantee you, if we had this kind of a program, having just been to 30, these trips have only been 37 states. Some states are garbage pits. I grew up in California. It breaks my heart. You go to a rest area in California, and there'll be a sign, $1,000 fine for littering, and literally the trash is all around it. I guarantee you, if one of the things I would have people do as a part of the boot camp, CCC, was pick up and recycle the things along the side of the road, this would be a cleaner country.
Yeah.
Because it's my country.
Right.
It's not just throw it out the door. You go, drive into a, I don't know if this ever happened to you, but you'd be sitting in a traffic sign and you see somebody throw a McDonald's bag out the window.
What? Luckily, I've not seen that. Yeah. That's terrible.
Yeah.
You know, it's anecdotal, but I backpack, I think we've talked for about 5 years. And as mm-hmm. I travel the world, and maybe it's just how it came to me, but I always felt like Israelis were just more naturally comfortable and connected to each other. When we would go into a hostel, they, you know, and again, there's obviously reasons for that. There's religion and it's a smaller country and but they all had service. It was military service.
Right
but
on.
They all did service when they turned 18 or 19 or whatever. And it made sense to me when I heard that. So I had the feeling before I had the knowledge, and the knowledge really validated the feeling.
Right. You know, I would go for military service, but it's going to be hard enough to sell a CCC kind of project. And one of the options would be you turn 18, you do the CCC kind of thing, or you go into the military for 2 or 3 years. We would be traveling. I love this story. I'm in Caldwell, Idaho. This mm-hmm. is west of Boise, RV park. We would always hike wherever we were. And we're out hiking around this reservoir, and we come to this weather-worn monument, CCC Project 1937. That project built a reservoir that allowed farms to exist and agriculture to exist in that valley. And they built a lot of national parks. They built dams. And I read one thing, it's a theory, I don't have any evidence of it, that when we went into World War II, one of the reasons we were able to mobilize so quick is there are a lot of people who have been in the CCC, and they knew how to work together with people different than them.
Yeah.
And once again, I don't have the statistics, and what you just described about Israel is spot on. I would say that our military has done more to integrate people than any other organization, any other institution. And so if we all serve together, when we come around together, we have this common bond. Right now, we don't have a common bond.
Yeah.
We don't have a common vocabulary. I saw this, you speak about going online. It was about Singapore, and I didn't realize that in the 1950s, the British left, and Singapore was this island with very diverse Indians and mm-hmm. Chinese and British. And they go, what do we do? And they were very vulnerable. And so they created required national service. There was a video of guys who had started, this was in the 50s, so now they're in the 60s. So they were probably in their 20s then, talking about, I never would have spoken to a Muslim or a Sikh if I hadn't had to serve together. And now we're friends. And we've been friends for 50 years.
Yeah. It's the antidote for social media and yeah.
We need to get this going.
And to be clear, I mean, it doesn't have to be mandated, right? There are other paths, right? It could be incentivized. It could be locally done. And
I grew up in Vietnam.
That's the easiest way to do it, but yeah.
Here's my challenge. During Vietnam, you know, the Creedence Clearwater Revival song, and one of their lines is, I'm no senator's son.
Mm-hmm. Let's get out of the draft.
They got out of the draft.
Yeah.
I mean, I got out of the draft by going to college.
Yeah.
No. We all need to turn 18 and serve. And until we do something like that, we're still going to be sitting here in 20 years or 30 years or not be what we are today if we don't do something dramatic.
Yeah. Well, so.
I need your help.
Yeah.
That's over coffee, right? Kawa, that's how we ended up in this conversation.
Yeah.
So we need to help each other.
Yes, agreed. So let's wrap up with some actionable items. So if you're, you know, from the book, from your experience, from your time working with executives, you know, assuming we have a decently wide demographic listening to us today, what are a few takeaways that people can integrate into daily life? You know, just a couple I think would be good so they can, you know, that they could take away and work.
Number one is get your news, your information from multiple sources. I listen to Fox, I listen to CNN, I listen to NPR, I listen to CNBC. It's hilarious because they're talking about the same thing, but it doesn't even sound like we're on the same planet.
Right.
But triangulate, learn to look and be open to other things. And to that end, vote for people who put nation ahead of party and are responsible stewards. We vote for what Uncle Harry says or whoever that you've decided that you're going to follow. I don't care who it is, Tucker Carlson or
Omar.
Anybody. Okay. Doesn't matter. Think before you vote. Get out and volunteer and get out and work in a Habitat for Humanity. But get out of your silo and work shoulder to shoulder with people who see the world through a different set of lenses and validate other people. Let somebody in the traffic. Open the door for somebody. It's hilarious. I now open the door everywhere I go. Some people walk through and say, thank you, thank you. And other people walk through and grunt. And other people don't say a word. They just are totally disconnected from the rest of us.
Micro-validations. Yeah. Wonderful. So the book is Unity in Service. It's available on Amazon. I will say the Kindle's on sale right now, so go grab it. Enjoy the conversation. Always enjoy our conversations and enjoy all the wisdom you put back into the world, in both in one-to-many with the books and the poems, but also in one-to-one with practicing what you preach. And it's great. It's a positive force in the world, and much appreciation for that.
Thanks, Joe.
Chip Webster, thank you.